Hi, Jim Paoletta here. I'd like to take some time and share with you my thoughts on patient assessment. One of the most important steps in establishing physiological hormone balance in a patient is the initial assessment of the individual's needs. A comprehensive medical evaluation form should be completed by the patient prior to the first interview with the practitioner. This evaluation should include medical history, with an emphasis on hormone-related history, lifestyle issues including diet, exercise, nutrition, and stress, and a thorough rating of the patient's symptoms. Attempting to assess hormone deficiencies and imbalances by symptoms alone can be very confusing. This is due in part to the vast overlap of symptoms caused by different hormone deficiencies, excesses, and imbalances. A great example of this is hot flashes occurring in a perimenopausal woman. Conventionally, most of us were trained that hot flashes were caused by low estrogens. However, hot flashes occur most often when women are in perimenopause, and at that stage of hormonal life, estrogen actually is a bit higher than during premenopause. The monthly signal to develop the dominant follicles delivered to less viable eggs that do not respond adequately, and therefore the signal is repeatedly delivered to the ovaries, resulting in a slightly higher than normal level of estrogen production. Estrogen levels do fluctuate vastly in perimenopause, but the overall level does not drop until the last 6 to 12 months of perimenopause. The hot flashes these women experience can be triggered by the fluctuations, but the actual cause may be low progesterone, because progesterone affects estrogen receptor sensitivity. It could be caused by excess estrogen or excess progesterone, which both downregulate estrogen receptors. The hot flashes could be caused by high cortisol, because it blocks estrogen receptors, or low cortisol, which results in less density of receptors, or insulin resistance, which causes an FSH-LH imbalance and stimulates estrogen and testosterone production from the ovaries, or it could be caused by low thyroid function, or it may be caused by a combination of any of these imbalances. What we were typically taught, that hot flashes are caused by low estrogens, is probably the opposite of what is really happening in the perimenopausal woman. As a side, conventionally we were also trained that estrogen needs should be determined by measuring FSH. FSH is controlled primarily not by estrogen, but by inhibin, a hormone secreted from the corpus luteum. An elevated FSH indicates lack of production of the corpus luteum from anovulation. It does not necessarily correlate well with estrogen levels. Weight gain, that's another great example of a symptom that can be caused by multiple hormonal imbalances. Weight gain can be caused by estrogen dominance, lack of estrogen and progesterone, low testosterone levels or low testosterone function, high or low cortisol levels, or low thyroid function. Poor sleep could be caused by high cortisol levels, low cortisol levels, high estrogen levels, progesterone deficiency, or high androgen levels. Fatigue may be caused or aggravated by excess estrogen, low cortisol levels, low androgen levels, low thyroid function. Even if you group symptoms together, a group of symptoms, they can still overlap significantly with other hormone imbalances. If you look at the symptoms of low testosterone in males, those symptoms overlap considerably with the symptoms of low thyroid function and those of poor nutrition. Symptoms of excess estrogen, excess progesterone, or high cortisol all overlap extensively with symptoms of estrogen deficiency. If that wasn't confusing enough, it is also difficult to base an assessment on need of symptoms alone, because the symptoms of too much hormone in some cases mimic closely the symptoms of too little of that same hormone. When the body senses too much genomic activity of a hormone, it has several protective mechanisms in place to lower the activity or function of that hormone. There can be negative feedback on endogenous production of the hormone, there can be downregulation of the hormone receptor, or there can be increased binding globulins for that hormone. In the case of excess estrogens in females, and excess testosterone in males, the tendency appears to be both suppression of endogenous production and downregulation of the receptors. This process is not an immediate reaction. In females, it may be a period of 1 or 2 months before receptors are downregulated. So a woman that is using an excessive amount of estrogen may have symptom improvement at first, but most often symptoms return after a relatively short period of time. The same process occurs in males that are using excess testosterone, but typically in a more delayed response. Males may not downregulate testosterone receptors in response to excess testosterone, typically for any time from 2 to 10 months, depending on the individual's response and the amount of excess. When a female is given exogenous estrogen, whether she needs less of it or none of it at all Initially, there's an increase in the number and sensitivity of estrogen receptors. Her initial response is more estrogen activity, resulting in many cases an improvement in symptoms. The same process occurs when a male is given exogenous testosterone he doesn't need or is in excess of what he needs to supplement. When downregulation occurs, it doesn't happen equally in all symptoms throughout the body, in all systems throughout the body. For example, estrogen receptors can be downregulated in the hippocampus and blood vessels, resulting in hot flashes. At the same time, if estrogen receptors in the breast tissue are not downregulated, then breast tenderness can occur. It's typical of the patient on excess estrogen to experience both symptoms of excessive estrogen and deficiency of estrogen at the same time. With receptor downregulation due to excess estrogen, some symptoms may reappear and others may not, or new symptoms might occur. Even if there is good symptom management, evidence shows that at a super physiological level, protective mechanisms of the hormones are diminished. For example, a physiological level of estradiol helps with cardiovascular protection. Protection increases with an increase if you have a low level of estradiol until a certain point is reached, and then any further increase in the level results in diminished protection. A higher than normal physiological level of estradiol also appears to increase insulin resistance, increase binding globulins that affect other hormones, specifically testosterone and thyroid. And with a higher than normal physiological level of estradiol, you also get decreased neuroprotective benefits. If your progesterone level is higher than normal physiological level, it inhibits insulin release from the pancreas. Even though normal levels of progesterone help stimulate insulin release, excess inhibits insulin release. Excess progesterone increases insulin resistance by antagonizing insulin. It causes hyperthyroidism. Thyroid receptors and progesterone receptors form dimer receptors, so the function of each is enhanced by a normal function of the other. Excess progesterone decreases neuroprotection and decreases immune function. A higher than normal physiological level of testosterone can cause decreased cardiovascular protection, interference with T3 function. Even though normal levels of testosterone help increase T3 production and release, excess interferes with the function at the receptor. A higher than normal physiological level of testosterone also decreases neuroprotection, as with estrogen and progesterone, but with testosterone, evidence shows that it may become excitotoxic at superphysiological levels. There are many protective benefits provided by physiological hormone balance, such as the effects on bone remodeling, that have not been studied to determine the effects of superphysiological levels. For these reasons, it is important to keep the hormone levels at a normal physiological level. Because we have this confusion that's created sometimes by trying to assess patients' needs based on symptoms alone because of these multiple hormonal pathways that can cause varied symptoms, appropriate hormone testing is required. Correlation of the test results with the symptoms help determine where there are actual deficiencies or excess in hormone levels and where there may be a functional deficiency of hormone due to other hormone imbalances or lifestyle issues. Testing. Testing can be done in a number of body fluids, including venous serum, capillary blood, urine, and saliva. All the methods have their advantages and disadvantages, and situations where the individual method of typing is invalid and results can be misleading. Let's talk about venous serum testing. It has some advantages. All the hormones are able to be tested. There's a lot of labs to choose from. The labs use standard automated methods with appropriate proficiency testing, and most of the tests are covered by the patient's insurance. Venous serum testing does have some disadvantages. Most of the labs still use the process for measuring androgens in females that was developed for males. It is not sensitive enough to give accurate measurement in women. A few labs are using a more sensitive testing procedure, and these labs provide normal ranges for different age groups, which then makes the results clinically useful. The majority of the larger labs provide a single testosterone DHEA range for all adult women, which along with the lack of sensitivity make the results useless for assessing need and adjusting doses. Venous serum testing may also only test total hormone and not indicate the amount of active, unbound, free hormone. Another issue with serum testing is the method used for testing progesterone does not differentiate well between progesterone and its metabolites, which can cause issues when a patient is supplementing exogenous oral progesterone. The most significant disadvantage with venous serum testing is it is not valid for testing once the patient is using topical hormone. Drug manufacturers provided us the idea that we could use conventional venous serum testing for their topical products by doing serum testing in their original studies. The amount of hormone found in the venous serum was 10% of the applied dose. So they redefined the word bioavailability and stated that topically delivered drugs was 10% bioavailable. Bioavailability concerns the amount of drug, or in this case hormone, at the site of action, not what remains in the venous serum. Another term that has been used misappropriately is the term absorption. The manufacturers have stated that topically applied hormone is only 10% absorbed. As far as topical hormones, absorption should describe how much goes across the skin into the body, not how much is excreted in the venous serum. Also, the manufacturer topical products use the word delivered to describe their products rather than use the standard term dose of the hormone. They claim that 5 milligrams of hormone was delivered when the actual dosage or amount that was applied to the skin and absorbed into the body was 50 milligrams. Manufacturers have avoided using the words dose and dosage with topical hormone administration, in my opinion, because it would remind practitioners just how much hormone they are putting into the body. None of these redefining of terms or changing dosing terminology means anything other than how much hormone is seen in the venous serum when applied topically. Using venous serum testing for topical application of hormones has never been validated. Validation would require either direct comparison to tissue measurement or a thorough evaluation of long-term effects totally through the system, neither of which have been done. Recent studies have shown that with topical application, venous serum does not accurately reflect the amount of hormone in the system. It gives a gross underestimation of hormone and may result in significant overdosing of patients. Venous serum testing should not be used with topical hormone administration. Urine testing. Probably the most important thing to remember about urine testing is that you're measuring hormone metabolites and not the actual hormone itself. While it is a non-invasive procedure, collecting urine for 24 hours is not convenient for a patient, and it is fairly expensive. Urine testing provides a good reflection of endogenous steroid production if a patient is not supplementing hormone. With oral hormone or pellet implant supplementation, urine testing may indicate an overestimation, as metabolites can interfere with the immunoassays that are used. Urine does not work for sublingual or buccal exogenous therapy, but with topical application, hormones can be are not reflective of tissue uptake. So basically, if you're using exogenous hormones, urine testing is not going to give you a very good indication of what's being delivered to the tissue. But let's look at an example on urine testing that can maybe indicate some of the confusion that's created. Let's say patient 1 is taking 100 milligrams of oral progesterone daily. Urine measurement would reflect the metabolites from 100 milligrams of progesterone. No one knows the exact bioavailability of an oral slow-release capsule of progesterone, but appears to be at least 10%. Using that figure, at least 10 milligrams is delivered to the tissue. To get a measurement of 100 milligrams of metabolites with about 10 milligrams being delivered to the tissue, patient 1 taking oral progesterone, 100 milligrams. Now, if we have patient 2, and she is applying 10 milligrams of topical progesterone daily, urine measurement would reflect metabolites from 10 milligrams of progesterone. Topical progesterone is high bioavailable, so the amount delivered to the tissue is pretty close to 10 milligrams. Now, if you compare the two patient urine test results side by side, patient 1 appears to have 10 times more progesterone in her system based on the metabolites, but the amount of hormone at the tissue where the hormone acts is equal for both patients. Urine testing is most beneficial to test metabolites when appropriate, such as determining how a patient is metabolizing her estrogens that she's supplementing. High levels of the more dangerous metabolites would indicate a need to implement nutritional lifestyle strategies to increase safer metabolism. Saliva testing. If done properly, saliva testing provides a good reflection of the tissue level of the hormone, whether it's endogenous or supplement. There are two exceptions to this. If a patient is using sublingual or buccal administration of hormones, or if the saliva testing lab that's being used does not have the data to determine an adjusted reference range for the route of administration used. With sublingual or buccal administration of hormone, you get a local pooling of hormone in the mucous membrane of the mouth. So Saliva testing would indicate an overestimation and the situation should not be used. Topically applied hormones will provide a greater level than those of endogenous hormone in saliva. The hormone that is absorbed travels by capillary blood, and there are two large capillary beds that feed the saliva glands, resulting in higher levels. A lab that has an established valid reference range for topical hormone must be used for proper interpretation of the results. The same is true with oral administration. You get slightly different numbers than your endogenous production, so you have to use a saliva lab that has a reference range established for that route of administration. Last one type of testing I'd like to talk about is capillary dry blood spot testing. This works well for both exogenous and endogenous hormones. The one concern that I have is patients are using topical hormones and applying or at all touching their hormone cream with their fingers. Contamination of the capillary blood can occur, resulting in an overestimation of hormone. Capillary blood spot testing also offers advantages of being able to measure larger proteins which cannot be tested in saliva, including things like sex hormone binding globulin, PSA, FSH, LH, IGF-1, insulin, high-sensitivity CRP, hemoglobin A1c, vitamin D, thyroid hormones, and thyroid antibodies, and others. For all methods of testing hormones, timing of the sample used for testing and the last dose of exogenous hormone need to be considered for proper interpretation. For example, if a patient is using a hormone once a day, testing at 24 hours or more after last dose does not give an adequate picture of the hormone level that that dose provides, unless, of course, the lab has used a reference range for that time interval. It's always best to use a lab that has reference ranges that incorporate consideration of the dosage route and dosage interval, as well as symptom management. Okay, once an individual's needs are determined by correlation of the personal background information, symptomology, and appropriate hormone tests, the next step is deciding the starting dose and dosage route for any hormone that needs to be supplemented. For females, estrogen should never be administered orally. There's three reasons for that. Most of an oral estradiol dose is converted to estrone, first past effect. The resulting estradiol levels may indicate a physiological amount in the system, but the amount of estrone is usually 3 to 7 times higher than it should be. Estrone is in part metabolized before catechol estrone, which can form DNA adjuncts, damage the DNA, and increase the risk of cancer. Second reason is oral estrogen increases sex hormone binding globulin and thyroid binding globulin in the liver, therefore decreases the amount of free testosterone and thyroid hormones. And thirdly, oral estrogen increases the risk of clotting and stroke. Estrogen is most commonly administered in a combination of estradiol 50% and estriol 50%, known as BIAS 50-50. Normal dosage range for topical administration is anywhere from 0.05 mg to 0.2 mg of each estrogen daily, usually with once daily application. Can be divided into twice a day. Some patients, I call them fast metabolizers, can't maintain symptom management once a day dosage and may have to go to twice a day. BIAS could also be used sublingually with the same dosage range as topical 0.05 mg to 0.20 milligrams daily, but estrogen sublingually should be divided into TID, 3 times a day dosing. The rule is always start at the low end of the dosage range and increase only as necessary. Any amount of exogenous estrogen administered does produce some 4-catechol estrogens, no matter what nutritional lifestyle preventive measures are undertaken. So any increase in estrogen increases metabolites involved in the increased risk of cancer. So we never give any estrogen unless it's needed. Never give estrogen unopposed by progesterone. Estrogen was not meant to be used alone in the body without progesterone. Progesterone does not work alone in the body without estrogen. Let's talk about progesterone. Progesterone is commonly administered in a slow-release capsule or topically. Normal dosage range for an oral capsule is anywhere from 25 milligrams to 400 milligrams. With the usual dose being 100 to 200 milligrams once daily before bedtime. Dose can be divided into BID dosing orally, but since oral progesterone can produce drowsiness, if progesterone is needed during the day, usually the oral bedtime dose is supplemented with a daytime topical administration. There are two advantages of using oral progesterone compared to topical. First, Oral progesterone produces more of the metabolite 4-allopregnanolone, which acts on the GABA receptor. It therefore has more of a calming, relaxing benefit, which can help with sleep. Secondly, for a woman who is still cycling, oral progesterone is cleared from the body much more quickly, resulting in a more rapid decline, closer to the normal drop. This helps initiate the menses. So oral progesterone is therefore often easier to regulate the cycle in a perimenopausal woman. For topically administered progesterone, the dosage range is anywhere from 5 to 50 milligrams daily, with the usual being 20 to 30 milligrams daily. Dosage can be, again, used once daily or divided into BID dosing. Topical testosterone normal dosage range, 0.25 milligrams to 2.0 milligrams, again, this is in females, once daily in the morning. The higher end of the range can be used to increase levels more quickly, then you can reduce the dose to the lower maintenance amount. Keep in mind the normal production for a young female for testosterone is 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams daily, so a supplemental maintenance dose can often be at the lower end of the dosage range. Testosterone could also be given sublingually at the same dosages should be divided into at least BID or twice a day dosage. DHEA can be given orally or sublingually, does not need to be made into a slow release capsule. Females usually require 2.5 milligrams to 20 milligrams daily, with the usual dose being 5 to 10 milligrams daily orally in the morning. If given topically, dosage range is 0.5 milligrams to 2.5 milligrams once daily in the morning. In females, DHEA can be given to restore both normal levels of DHEA and testosterone. DHEA is converted to testosterone, and both levels are increased if they're low in most females. Talk about the guys for a minute. Testosterone can be given by IM injection sublingually or topically. Normal dosage range for IM injection is 50 to 80 milligrams weekly. Normal dosage range for sublingual administration is 2.5 to 20 milligrams daily, with the usual being 5 to 10 milligrams. Daily dosage should be divided into twice a day dosage. For topical administration, normal testosterone dosage is 1 milligram to 20 milligrams daily, with the usual being 5 to 10 milligrams daily. Can be dosed once daily in the morning or divided in twice a day dosing, with the second dose usually given midday. DHEA in males is typically given orally or sublingually at a range of 5 to 25 milligrams daily in the morning. Progesterone is given to males, normal range of 5 to 20 milligrams orally, with the usual being 5 to 10 milligrams daily before bedtime. Topical progesterone in males administered in a normal range of 0.25 milligrams to 2.5 milligrams, with the usual being 1 to 2 milligrams daily. In males, if you need to inhibit aromatase activity, you can accomplish this by giving Arimidex orally, 0.5 to 1 milligram, given every other day to twice a week. You can use Aromasan orally at 25 milligrams, 2 to 3 times a week. There's a product by Zymogen called Aromat 8PN, that's an 80 milligram capsule given 1 to 2 times a daily. Chrysin can be used if given orally. Normal range is 500 to 3,000 milligrams daily. I usually use at least 1,500 milligrams orally to see that work in males. Topically, chrysin can be used too, anywhere from 30 to 100 milligrams daily, usually combined with the topical testosterone product that's compounded for the patient. Keep this in mind. For this physiological dosing to provide adequate symptom relief, the underlying adrenal dysfunction, functional hypothyroidism, high insulin levels, nutritional deficiency, and lifestyle issues such as a lack of sleep and adequate exercise need to be addressed. A physiological level provides symptom relief and protective benefits when function is optimized. Thanks for listening. I hope this has provided some good insights on patient assessment and hormone dosing.